thank you very much. Thank you for the Center for Philosophy of Religion also for having me and the Thomistic Institute. So just real quick, what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to try to address it at a lot of different levels. So there will be at points at which I'll be having to get into some rather technical concepts, but there will be also points where I'm trying to bring it together to a much more general set of questions that others can understand. So sometimes technical questions will probably need to come up in the Q&A, as well as other general questions. And so I invite all of those sort of questions at the end. In the lab that I work on, we don't talk about any of the kind of stuff in general that we're going to be working on. I work on a lab that works on rodent experiments that are looking on similar mechanisms as and trying to understand memory and perceptual mechanisms that are comparable to cases of dementia in human cases, and ultimately trying to come up with tasks that could be clinically used in the human case. So what I'll be talking about today is much more general, a lot more philosophical and metaphysical than what the day-to-day is going on in our particular lab. So the first question we want to ask is, why should we worry about the soul? There are a lot of different ways in which we use the concept or the idea of soul. Some of them are metaphysically innocuous, and they're just sort of another way of saying, like, my deepest desires, or my heart, or what I'm really interested in, or the things that I sort of find the ultimate meaning in life, a sort of more metaphorical or rhetorical, but no less serious way of talking about the soul. But I'm going to talk about the soul in a way that's more contentious and is more referenced to substantive metaphysical claims about a certain kind of entity or a certain way in which human beings or other beings are organized. The soul is, of course, used in lots of different ways, particularly in many different languages and different religions. And so I will be in particularly looking at views of the soul that more are due to the medieval and later Christian traditions. But there are lots of concepts of soul, and we might ask questions about to what degree can we still defend these or even hold these as true, various religious views about the soul. But the soul also has independent philosophical traditions, that some of which are attached to religious traditions, and others are just defending on strictly rational or philosophical grounds various accounts of the soul. And so we'll be looking at two different ones, and we'll be looking at a kind of Cartesian view about the soul, which had independent philosophical motivations, but it was, of course, developed within a sort of religious tradition. And in particular, I'm going to look at a kind of concept of soul that's not discussed as much today, but had a long pedigree in the Middle Ages, a more Aristotelian view of the soul, a view of the soul due to Aristotle. And questions we might ask today, as we find journalists talking about, we find philosophers and neuroscientists talking about, as to whether or not we can take serious the idea of this more substantive, this more metaphysical or ontological view about the soul in light of a scientific worldview, and in particular, what sort of challenges there might be to a concept of soul given some of the discoveries of neuroscience. So one question that's going to be central throughout the talk are these two questions. So whose soul, which scientific interpretation? And I'm going to be sort of giving a large sort of picture view and not necessarily all the arguments to sort of reinforce or defend the kind of view, but a sort of grand picture, and we could come to some of those arguments in the Q&A. But the Aristotelian view of soul is slowly, in some niche communities, growing in philosophy, but there's also other communities that think that we'd be better off if we weren't publishing their articles and we didn't take that seriously. But there is nevertheless a growing interest in certain neo-Aristotelian approaches, and some of us who are defending those views owe it to our interlocutors and those who are interested in what we have to say to try to provide something of a substantive account of what we might mean by the soul today in a sort of Aristotelian sort of way. But a central question is going to be, which conception of soul are we talking about, and what sort of neuroscientific experiments under which interpretation raises questions or objections to these rival views of soul? So there's different views of souls. There's quite a few neuroscientific experiments, and there's different interpretations of those one and the same experiments. And what I want to focus on are a range of distinctions and questions, and it's true that I'm going to be putting forward a lot of contentious claims and conclusions, and I hope some arguments for some of those conclusions too. But the more important point is, I think, to try to get a handle on some of the concepts and the distinctions, the kinds of questions that I'm asking, because This question's not going to be resolved this evening, and it's not going to be resolved anytime soon. But you're going to always be reading articles in the newspaper, various things coming through social media, of new scientific experiments, new discoveries in neuroscience. And getting a handle on these concepts allows you to critically evaluate how you would read those articles and how you would engage in various conversations and discussions. And you might find these distinctions ultimately provide reasons for rejecting religious views of souls, but maybe defending a philosophical view, or accepting certain philosophical views and certain religious views, or perhaps just saying the whole bit is rubbish, and some of these distinctions would help you articulate why you thought those views were really defensible and true, or rubbish. On the handout, I've got four different sections. The first two on the first page, and then on the back side, I've got the other two. And so, does anyone need a handout? So we've got four major headings here of a set of distinctions that will be coming up in these headings that I want you to sort of pay attention to and try to work on. And the handout will provide the opportunity to reflect on these as well as raise some questions of perhaps clarification later on. But the first question is, whose soul? What kind of concept of soul? And there's a lot of different philosophical and religious ones, but I'm going to focus on two philosophical views about souls, both of which were found various developments and articulations in the Christian tradition, and the Aristotelian view found variations and developments in the medieval Islamic tradition as well as the medieval Jewish tradition, and then eventually was received into the Latin Christian tradition around the beginning of the 13th century. So the two views of souls I'm going to look at are Cartesian minds and then Aristotelian animating forms. Second, we're going to move on to a distinction that's pretty well known in contemporary philosophical literature and somewhat in cognitive science literature, of a distinction between personal level and subpersonal level attributes, a distinction that Dennett articulated in 1969 in Content and Consciousness, but is a distinction that was kind of operative in a number of philosophers before that. And we're going to look at it and its application in two different kinds of approach to souls, namely emergentist dualism and then hylomorphic animalism. The emergentist view is a kind of post-Cartesian view, but maybe some emergentists wouldn't like that kind of label. And the hylomorphic animalism view could be conceived as a kind of Aristotelian view, but there would be hylomorphic animalists that wouldn't really necessarily want to attach themselves to anything Aristotle said. And then we're going to look at Aristotelian souls after neuroscience. And in particular, I want to look at a certain philosophical approach to neuroscience that I think provides arguably a complementary way of thinking about the philosophy of neuroscience from a group or approach called the New Mechanist Philosophy, which investigates various aspects in the philosophy of biology, the philosophy of neuroscience, and the philosophy of psychology. And then the fourth section, I'm going to return to the rational soul after neuroscience. So let's start with these two kinds of souls. The first kind of souls, I think, are the kind of souls that most people are probably more familiar when they think of souls or spirits. And broadly speaking, we could think of this in terms of Cartesian minds, the kind of minds that René Descartes identified. And Descartes initiates aspects of his philosophical approach to the mind, to the soul, by employing a mental-physical dichotomy, a distinction between mental attributes and physical attributes. So thinking about consciousness or a thinking thing versus thinking about physical things, extended things. And for Descartes, or at least some views of Cartesian minds, they would hold that there's two substances, two kinds of properties as well. There's mental substance and there are the physical substances. And the mental substances are the thinking thing, the conscious thing, the thing that believes and desires and has various mental properties. And then there's the physical substance, the one that's material or is extended, perhaps extended in space and time. On this Cartesian view of the mind or the soul, the spirit, I am my mind, but I can be united to a body, but the body is other than me. I'm not a body, but perhaps I have a body. This is, I think, a pretty common view about what souls or minds or spirits mean. There's a lot of sophisticated arguments for this. There's equally a large number of sophisticated critiques of this view. There's a lot more I could say about it, obviously, but this view has kind of gotten the lion's share of both objections and defenses in the contemporary literature in terms of how it is still compatible with various versions or claims that have been made in the neurosciences, as well as various criticisms on behalf of physicalism or various particular features from neuroscience. What I'm going to focus on is an Aristotelian view, which I think is much less well known, at least in the contemporary, for a contemporary audience, a sort of Aristotelian view of souls as animating forms. So Aristotelians think of souls as simply just a type of formal organization. That's the formal organization of a living being as opposed to a non-living being. So for an Aristotelian, the first way to think about souls is much more of as a kind of metaphysical biological concept, not a religious one, not a spiritual one. It's much more something that is important for Aristotle's general view about form and matter. And Aristotelians like a lot to use these technical terms like hylomorphism, which many of you are probably not familiar with. And this comes from, it's not a term that Aristotle himself uses, but Aristotle talks a lot about matter and form. These are fundamental concepts in Aristotelian thought. And from them, from the Greek word for matter, hule, and the Greek word for form, morphe, a later term came about to sort of identify this doctrine of hylomorphism. So hylomorphism is a doctrine where there's one substance, and this one substance is composed or constituted from the unity of organic matter animated by form. So that's a description of a hylomorphic living being. Aristotle thinks that non-living beings, inanimate beings, are also composed of form and matter. But their kind of form is not an animating form, a kind of form that makes the substance alive. Their kind of form is one that just brings about a type of organized, inanimate, or non-living physical substance. So forms for Aristotle's philosophy, both through the work of providing the organization for physical, non-living things, and those same forms also provide a story or an explanation for the formal organization of living things. And in the case of living things, their animation, the animation of their organized material components, that organization, that form, Aristotle calls a soul. Okay? So it's not something existing independent from the body, it's the form is the explanation for the kind of organization and animation that a living thing has. And Aristotle distinguishes three different kinds of animating formal organization that you find in material substances. He distinguishes vegetative souls, sentient souls, and rational souls. So this is often sometimes thought of as being problematic, as if like plants have some sort of spiritual soul that would exist after the plant itself corrupts. And that's not what Aristotle has in mind. He simply has in mind, like I said, all of these physical substances have different kinds of composition and organization. Their matter is always composed and organized in various ways, and that organization gives them various powers and capacities. In the case of living beings, he just distinguishes the kind of form that organizes them, and he calls it a soul. And a soul endows plants, or at least vegetative life forms, with different powers of nutrition and growth. And those same powers are also found in sentient beings, animals, and their formal organization of their soul endows them with powers of sensation, of movement, of conscious attention. And rational souls also have those other capacities, but they also endow those beings with a type of formal organization that gives them powers of intellectual understanding and volition, acts of knowing and acts of loving. So there's a lot more to be said about Aristotelian animating forms, and we're going to go quite a few more, a few levels deeper in trying to explain some of the details of his view so it makes more sense. So this is drawing on a contemporary hylomorphist who's not necessarily an Aristotelian but does defend a version of hylomorphism. I've slightly modified it. His name is William Jaworski. And Jaworski gives us some slogans that can help capture what exactly we're talking about with these forms. So he says that substantial forms, the sort of forms that bring about the organization of a whole substance, there's three slogans we can think about for them. First, substantial form organization matters. It operates as an irreducible ontological principle, one that accounts at least in part for what things essentially are. He also says substantial formal organization makes a difference. It operates as an irreducible explanatory principle, one that accounts at least in part for what things can do, the powers they have. He says substantial organization, formal organization counts. It explains the unity of composite things, including the persistence of one and the same living individual through the dynamic influx and efflux of matter and energy that characterize many of its interactions in the wider world. So these are three things that these substantial forms are meant to do. They're not existing independent from the matter. They're the explanation for why the matter is organized in the way that it is and why the physical substance has the powers that it is. Okay, so that's a pretty quick run through on this first half of these two different kinds of souls. We're going to dig a little deeper and articulate a few more points about what exactly Aristotelian souls do, and in particular, the nature of their powers. So this brings us to some other ways of contrasting these different views about souls by looking at this distinction between the personal level and subpersonal level attributes. This distinction, I think, is helpful because there's a lot of ways of articulating it and a lot of different implications one can draw on the basis of this distinction. So this distinction alone doesn't tell you what the metaphysics is going to be. And there are a lot of different ways of thinking about the connection between personal level and subpersonal level attributes that one can go on to argue for. So let's clarify briefly what generally a lot of people are thinking when they speak of this distinction. So personal level attributes include things like conscious awareness, perception, emotion, memory, imagination, inquiry, insight, practical and theoretical reasoning, intentional action, beliefs, desires, and so forth. By subpersonal level attributes, they mean things like the brain or the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, digestive systems, various systems that often it's articulated in terms of they enable or they make possible the psychological attributes of the personal level, but they aren't able to do the things that the personal level attributes can do. So one claim from this would be that the nervous system doesn't have attributes like conscious awareness, but the nervous system and its apt functioning, its appropriate organization, is what enables conscious awareness for a person. Okay. So I'm also going to sometimes speak in terms of the psychological level and the subpsychological level, in part because I want to sort of extend this distinction and also use it for talking about non-human animals that we may or may not think about controversially whether they're persons or not. So independently of that controversial debate, I'm going to use this extended account of psychological and subpsychological to talk about animals. One thing to be said about this distinction, it's not a panacea. It's not going to solve every problem or all the issues that you would want to address. It just is providing a nice way of sort of setting up a debate or setting up a set of questions so that we can dig deeper as to what we think the relationship is between these personal attributes. What's their causal or their reductive status with respect to the subpersonal? But another point to be made is that it's not equivalent to a mental-physical dichotomy. When we talk about the personal level attributes, that doesn't mean we're talking about mental attributes to the exclusion of physical attributes. The personal level attributes might well also be physical attributes. So it's not equivalent to that dichotomy, but there one could try to argue it that way. The way I'm using the distinction, or the way I'm going to be using it at least in the talk, is that it can be understood hylomorphically. So these personal level attributes, many of them, like conscious awareness, perception, emotion, they're as much physical, they're much embodied in the animal as they are mental features as well. So the mental aren't necessarily at odds with or distinct from the physical. So how does this distinction figure in with the kind of emergentist or dualist view about the personal and the subpersonal? How can we think of them in terms of this? And I describe this as a cartoon. This is a bit fast, and emergentists in the room might protest that I've treated their view a bit too quickly. But the idea of an emergentist view of the mind, which is a sort of property dualism, it could be a type of emergentist substance dualism as well, is a view that the mental properties of the mind, all those personal level properties I just mentioned, they all emerge from the organization, perhaps, of the nervous system. So the physical neural organization produces or generates a distinct and extrinsic mind and mental properties. So you have the physical base of the nervous system, and it might be very complex, and the complex organization generates or creates something distinct, a distinct property or maybe even a distinct mental or mind power or substance. But what the nervous system is as a physical system is one thing, and what it's able to produce or generate in terms of the mental attributes is another thing. And the causation here from emergentists is normally two-way. So the physical brain, it generates and introduces new information for the mind. The point here is two. Both the complexity of the brain generates the mind, generates conscious awareness, generates these separate mental properties, but it also continually feeds the mind, its conscious states, with new information. As one explores the world and goes all around, the body and the nervous system are detecting information, and it's somehow shuffling up that information into the conscious awareness of a separate emergent mind or person. But likewise, the arrows of causation can go back down. So the mental properties of the mind can cause changes in the physical properties of the brain and the body. So a complex brain generates a separate property, a mind or mental properties. But those mental properties, beliefs and desires, the intentional actions to try to move across the room, can then causally act back on the brain, causing the body to allow the being to walk across the room. Okay? So that's a kind of Cartesian emergentist view. And the question I want to ask is, how should we think about the personal and subpersonal distinction on this view? And the personal level is where we're going to identify the mind and the mental properties, but the subpersonal level is going to involve the brain and the body. And what I just want to see is contrast this with the Aristotelian view. I'm not giving you arguments one way or the other for accepting this view or rejecting this view, likewise with the Aristotelian one. It's more of a point of trying to clarify what exactly the Aristotelian view is saying in the first place about souls and what it has to say with respect to neuroscience. So here's the view of the hylomorphic animalist. And again, this is another very quick sketch. A lot more would be needed to fill out this view. The first view here is that animals are a kind of fundamental entity. Second, animals on this Aristotelian view are unified psychosomatic wholes. So by psychosomatic, I mean somehow the psychology and the body are bound up together. The psychology is deeply embodied. Whereas on the emergentist view, we had the mental properties were somehow emergent and distinct and separate from the body. On this view, through the Aristotelian account of form and matter, the psychological organization of the body and the body's organization is due to the psychological powers. So this account of psychosomatic, which can be used in a lot of ways, the way I'm using it here is in a hylomorphic way of thinking about form and matter. And the psychological is itself embodied in the organization of structures like the nervous system. So animals on this account are unified psychosomatic wholes that are not only more than the sum of their parts. The actualization, the identity, and the subsistence conditions of an animal's material parts are determined by its substantial form. So there's a lot of complex metaphysics in that statement that we don't have time to go into the details of, but perhaps in the Q&A. One thing that's significant that should come out in this sort of Aristotelian view is the way in which it's a type of organization or form realism. So organization is a very critical part of reality. Organization explains all those different factors about what matters, what makes a difference, and what counts in the world. But Aristotelians distinguish between two kinds of organization. Thus far, I've just talked about the kind of organization of the soul and the way in which it provides the explanation for the organization of a living body, the reason why the material components of an animal are alive and organized the way they are. That, in Aristotelian lingo, is sometimes called the substantial form, the form of the substance. But they also talk about other types of forms, forms that are grounded or dependent on the substance, sometimes called conjugate or accidental forms. So Aristotelians distinguish between substantial form and matter, as well as properties that are conjugate or accidental compositions of form and matter. And so the idea here is that the substance, the animal, grounds its conjugate powers and operations. So by way of contrast to the emergentist picture where the personal level, where the separate mental properties, the emergent mental properties and operations, whereas the subpersonal was the body and the brain, the Aristotelian hylomorphic animalism view is very different here. On the personal level, we have the animal hylomorphic substance, its conjugate psychological powers and operations, right? So the personal level for the Aristotelian view includes a lot of embodied psychological powers. Your power of vision is embodied in the nervous system and in your eyes. It's part of the visual cortex, and it's part of your eyes as well. Your abilities for memory are embodied in parts of the subcortical regions of your brain and the medial temporal lobe. And so memory is not some emergent mental property separate and generated by the organization of the hippocampi, but is actually part of the embodied organization of the hippocampi. However, the subpersonal level, that's where the organized material components of these psychological powers are. So if we're going to give a description of memory and talk about the way in which we might navigate our way in and out of this building, that's going to be a personal level description for the hylomorphist. But if we want to talk about the way in which the medial temporal lobe or the hippocampi work, the way in which they function, that's going to be a subpersonal level or sub-psychological description. And what's going on at that subpersonal, sub-psychological level is constitutive and enables what's going on at the memorative level, but is not the same thing as the activities going on at the psychological, at the memorative level. So we can then say a number of other claims about these conjugate or accidental forms, especially with respect to psychological powers. So just as we said a number of claims about the substance, we can now say a bunch of claims about the properties of a hylomorphic animal. And here again, modifying slightly Jaworski's claims, we can say that conjugate or accidental formal organization matters. So it's an irreducible ontological principle that organized activities possess essentially, and which in part accounts for the very nature of what the activities are that they organize. Again, a lot of technical metaphysical language here, but fortunately for these, they're on your handout, so I think they are at least. Yes, they are, on the first page. So you can look at them and mull over them more later. The second one is that conjugate formal organization makes a difference. Because it's the form of a power which provides an irreducible explanatory principle, and powers enable individuals to engage in organized activities they could not perform without such powers. Powers to move around, powers to see, powers to digest your food, powers to acquire or explore the environment and acquire food, a whole range of different kinds of powers. And then conjugate formal organization counts. It confers unity on diverse events in a way that is similar to how substantial forms confer unity on physical materials that compose organized individual substances. And then finally, conjugate formal organization psychologizes. That is, it allows for an animal to have psychological powers, these personal level powers, powers of sensation, perception, affectivity, understanding, rational reflection, intentional action. These are all species of organized activities of psychological powers. So the point here is to see the way in which the substance of the animal is composed of both substantial form, that substantial form for the Aristotelian is an animating form, so it's a soul, that organizes the central matter of the substance, and that grounds a whole range of vegetative, sentient, and rational powers in the case of human beings, a range of these psychological powers. So this is captured by this second point here. Animals have the psychosomatic powers and operations they do in virtue of the organization of specific zones of their material parts by their conjugate forms. In other words, the subpsychological capacities of our nervous system enable the psychosomatic capacities, which are constituted from the organization of subpsychological systems like the brain. A lot of technical terminology there. The last point is just saying that, as we're going to clarify in the next section, that the subpsychological systems are organized by our psychosomatic powers in a way that gives rise to the conscious psychological operations that the animal is able to exercise. We'll go over more of that in detail in the next section. Okay. So now to the other side. So far I've contrasted for you a range of different views about souls, the Cartesian minds, and then I've given a quick picture and I've focused much more on the Aristotelian view, not providing anything like a critique or a refutation of this Cartesian or these emergentist views, but views that I think are a little bit more familiar to many to show, by way of contrast, the differences for this Aristotelian view. And here again, we're going to see a few more ways of contrasting the Aristotelian view. And this way, we're going to look at one pretty well-known idea about personal identity and contrast that with some aspects of the Aristotelian one. The first thing I want to say is that when we ask questions philosophically or in terms of common sense about what we are, what are human beings, some philosophers like the language of the idea of the manifest image of what a human being is, or maybe the folk psychological concept of what a human being is, or the common sense psychological. And both in scientific literature and philosophical literature, we sometimes use these phrases rather quickly. But it's, I think, important to point out that there's not a common sense view about what the human being is, and there's not a manifest image of what the human being is. There's a lot of rival and different views, and if you did a proper ethnopsychology, if you looked historically and then contemporarily at a lot of different ways in which people self-understand themselves and self-conceptualize them, it would show that some of the philosophical views, or even most of the philosophical views, are just one limited view amongst others. So how do we negotiate, and how are we work our way through these different rival views of these manifest images? So two philosophical versions of a kind of manifest image that are then theorized and worked out in terms of different views about personal identity are what I'm very briefly and quickly referring to as the Neo-Lockean view about psychological identity, a view that comes from John Locke and has been articulated and defended in a lot of different ways. But this sort of idea about what we are, our psychological identity, rests fundamentally on a certain kind of continuity of either memory or consciousness. Okay, there's a lot to be said about this view, and I don't have time to go into both the arguments for it, the various complications for it. An alternative view is the Aristotelian view. And the Aristotelian view is sometimes today tagged up with a view called animalism. Some animalists say they're not neo-Aristotelians, and some neo-Aristotelians say they're not animalists, but there are also quite a few animalists that are Aristotelians. And this is a view that, rather than focusing on the continuity of our psychological states or the continuity of our memories with who we are and what we remember who we are and perhaps maybe a narrative understanding of our lives and how the events have gotten us to where we're at today, the Aristotelian view isn't opposed to that, but it's suggesting that there's something more fundamental about personal identity, something that underlies this sort of psychological identity. And they would claim that there's this type of organic continuity from the beginning to the end of the life of a developing, dependent, rational animal. So human beings are a kind of animal, and they have the kind of continuity that other animals have, a type of biological continuity. And it's a biological continuity that is changing considerably, especially changing within the first 20 years of our lives, but it doesn't stop changing, it continues to develop. It reaches a certain sort of peak in terms of our physical powers, and then it starts to decline in a lot of different ways. And so we're developing animals, but we're also dependent. We're social animals. We depend upon various factors in our environment, as well as various social factors to help bring about our rearing, our education, and our moral and various other types of psychological development. So they want to hit on the important point about this organic biological continuity, and even this sort of developmental factor, not just with respect to our biological continuity, but even our psychological development depends upon a lot of factors in this organic continuity. So the rational animal's personhood grounds the biological and the psychological powers that enable the conscious life and development of the rational animal's personality. So Aristotelians want to distinguish two aspects about personal identity. First, they want to talk about our psychological identity, maybe what we might call our personality. But Aristotelians don't think that that sort of conscious states have this sort of seamless, perfect continuity. Our personalities change and develop a lot throughout life. Our social interactions, what stages of life we're at, the kind of friends and relationships we have, as well as various neurodegenerative or brain damage or lesions or various problems that we also have health-wise, can radically change our psychological personality. But for them, our ontological identity, our sort of metaphysical, biological identity, our personhood, persists throughout that. So a lot more to be said about those distinctions, but here's the contrast between this Neo-Lockean account, where it's focused more on our consciousness and our psychology, versus the Aristotelian one is much more focused on a sort of metaphysical, biological continuity, and that's what enables the psychological continuity that the Lockean focuses on. So there's a lot more things I could say about different varieties or different views about the manifest image, about our common sense view. That was just one illustration of ways in which we think about our ordinary personal identity of who we are, who I was before. We can also think about different varieties of scientific images. So we often hear very quick journalist claims about science says this, or these scientists say that. But when you dig in, science has so many sub-disciplines within sub-disciplines, and they publish in lots of different journals. And one lab down the hall might be investigating something similar about rodent motivation. They radically disagree with the people that are down the hall. And so there are consensuses in science, but there's also a whole range of complicated disagreements. And it depends on which scientist you're talking to, from which faculty investigating in which research program. And so one quick example of this that I want to look at is an example of disagreements in the scientific literature, in neuroscience in particular, which has to do with different views about how we coordinate with respect to neuroscience, our personal level attributes, and our subpersonal level attributes. So you might think that a psychological personal level attribute like vision has one really well-defined area in the brain. And so if you have damage to this part of the brain, you might completely lose vision. Or if you have damage to another part of the brain, you might completely lose memory. And so how should we think about memory, a personal level attribute, vis-a-vis or with respect to the sub-psychological parts of the brain? And what's developing in the literature right now are three kind of rival views, but really two of them are kind of the dominant ones. One's more of a localist or modularity view, where there's something pretty close to a one-to-one correspondence. So if you have a personal level or psychological ability for vision, there's going to be basically one or a certain areas of the brain, and those areas are dedicated, domain-specific, to the powers or the operations of vision. But there's another view, a type of view of holism, where maybe contingently it's come about that these are the parts of the brain that are required for memory. But it could have been that other areas of the brain might also be able to facilitate our personal level attributes for memory. And that would be a kind of holism. I'm sorry, the illustration is really terrible, so it's hard to see. The third view is a type of reuse. I can maybe make this a little clearer with this diagram. This diagram is only showing us the localism on the top, and then it's only showing us the reuse on the bottom. So for the localist view, the modularity view, you could see that the connections are between areas of the brain 2, 4, 5, and 6. Let's say that those are all areas of the brain that are used for memory and only for memory. That would be the localist view. Whereas perhaps areas like 3, 1, and 2 are only areas that are used for vision. And so 2 seems to somehow be perhaps an area where vision and memory somehow link up. But these areas of the brain are only going to be used for vision, and then where vision overlaps with memory, and these other areas of the brain are only going to be used for memory. So that's the sort of localist view. But there's a rival interpretation, sometimes called the massive redeployment hypothesis or neural reuse. And this is a view, as you can see, where different areas of the brain are used for different things. So maybe perhaps memory works in a way that 1 through 6, all those different areas distributed throughout the brain are used. But maybe there's some special thing like a type of rational planning, which has to draw upon certain areas of memory. In order to plan something, I need to know what I've done before and how that was successful, and I can draw on that. So perhaps some types of rational planning, they don't include all the areas of memory, but they use some of the areas of memory, and so they get reused. And likewise, you might have some other sort of task that's not necessarily rational planning, but actually executing an activity that requires memory or something rather different. So this is a view where different parts of the brain can be used in different ways when they're functionally united with other areas. We're not going to get to the depths of this debate or try to resolve this debate, and it's an empirical debate for the neuroscientists to work out, but it's one where how do we coordinate the personal level attributes with the subpersonal ones is very much a live debate today, and there's a lot of different views that one could take there. Okay. Now I'm going to come a little bit more detail to a particular neuroscience debate that is, I think, relevant for this Aristotelian picture. And this is still connected to both varieties of scientific images as well as varieties of the manifest image, where they kind of come together and unite. And the first question we're going to ask is, whose ontology and which philosophy of neuroscience? So there are quite a few different approaches to the philosophy of neuroscience and how we should think about the neuroscience and maybe how the neuroscience connects up with personal level attributes. A lot of philosophy of neuroscience has no interest in these personal level questions at all. But some of it does. And the question here is what kind of ontology, a view about Cartesian souls or a view that it's just strictly a type of materialism, of which there are many varieties, or maybe a version of Aristotelian hylomorphic animalism. There's different alternative views in the ontology, and we need to ask which ones of these fit with the type of philosophy of neuroscience that we also find favorable. So one thing to make clear is that hylomorphism is not a philosophy of neuroscience. What it is a type of ontology or metaphysical view about inanimate and animate physical things. And what we're going to talk about is one particular view in the philosophy of neuroscience called the new mechanist approach, and it's a philosophy of science, in particular, a philosophy of biology, neuroscience, and psychology. Now, the new mechanists are generally not interested in hylomorphism. There are a few of them that are interested in ontology and interested in substance attribute ontologies, but they're not interested in Aristotelian hylomorphism. So I'm not trying to give a suggestion that I think new mechanists might find it strange or rather bizarre that their view was being brought in to talk about some of this Aristotelian hylomorphism. But there are a few new mechanists that are interested, at least in some of the neo-Aristotelian work, but perhaps not the hylomorphist work in particular. So what is this new mechanist approach in philosophy of neuroscience? So I'm going to run through a number of details here, but some of them are on your handout. So one of the most important early work or articles for talking about mechanisms was this early paper in 2000, or this paper in 2000 called Thinking About Mechanisms. And they write saying that in many fields of science, what is taken to be a satisfactory explanation requires providing a description of a mechanism. So it's not surprising that much of the practice of science can be understood in terms of the discovery and descriptions of mechanisms. And there's a lot to be said about this approach. One thing is they stress focusing on the actual practices of neuroscientists and sort of evaluating them, but they're also less interested in laws, because there aren't laws that are typically part of the everyday practices of biology and neuroscience, but much more focused on these tractable hypotheses about mechanisms and attempts to actually discover them in the biological phenomena and try to understand what they are. So an important point for the new mechanists is contrasting what they mean by mechanisms from what older views of mechanisms, maybe perhaps more familiar views about mechanisms. The first thing is for them is mechanisms are not machines. Also, not all mechanisms are deterministic. Many of them are stochastic. They're a certain degree of indeterminacy and improbability, maybe perhaps just epistemic, not ontological. They're not reductionistic. Most mechanisms, as we'll see in a second, require multi-level, irreducible ontic structures. Likewise, a lot of mechanisms aren't necessarily localizable. Some mechanisms in the brain are highly distributed in lots of different areas. That would still actually be compatible with the localism that we just talked about. It would be compatible with both a localism and a type of neural reuse. Because just saying it might still be just these different distributed areas and they only do this domain-specific task. And a further point about mechanisms that are not fictions or metaphors or explanatory heuristics, for they describe and explain ontic structures in the world. So what are mechanisms for the new mechanists? Here's three quotes, but I'm just going to focus on the last one by Karl Kraber from his book, Explaining the Brain. He says that mechanisms are entities and activities organized in such a way that they exhibit the explained phenomenon. And you can see I've highlighted the key components that Kraber identifies. And as you can probably guess, what attracts an Aristotelian hylomorphist to this account is the role in which organization plays with respect to these component activities and entities for generating or producing a phenomenon. So this is a typical diagram that you'll see in Kraber and other new mechanist works. And the idea is that there's some sort of phenomenon which is a whole, some sort of product or some sort of product that might be produced by the mechanism as a whole. And you can see here a number of component entities and then there are various component activities. So when we describe mechanisms, we start off with this sort of black box schema, and we don't really necessarily know what any of these things are. And it's through the empirical investigations that we slowly begin to sketch more detail what these component entities are and what their actual activities are. And it's because of the appropriate organization, the temporal, spatial, and functional organization of these entities and their activities that they generate some whole, that they generate some phenomenon, or they as a whole generate some phenomenon. So here's how they characterize a phenomenon. It's variously described as the behavior or the manifestations of a capacity or a power of the mechanism taken as a whole. A phenomenon is the behavior and mechanism as a whole. The mechanism for protein synthesizes proteins. So all the different components that are required for charting out and figuring out how proteins get synthesized, when you put all those components together, all their activities, the appropriate organization, the whole that's generated is going to be a protein. The mechanisms for an action potential of a neuron is what generates an action potential in a neuron. And a mechanism for opening ion channels is what causes ion channels on the cell membrane of a neuron to open and close, as well as the mechanism for long-term potentiation, which is a type of synaptic plasticity, is going to induce synaptic plasticity in a neuron. So the three features that mechanisms help us explain with respect to phenomenon are: mechanisms explain how organized entities and activities produce, they underlie, or they can maintain some phenomenon. So there's a lot of complexities to their view, but if you're thinking in a biological way, think perhaps maybe how a protein is going to be generated, or maybe how an action potential and a neuron is generated. The various component entities of these mechanisms, they have properties like location, size, structure, duration, orientation. They typically have masses, carry charges, and transmit momentum. Enzymes, neurotransmitters, neurons, organs, organisms, see how it's getting bigger and bigger kinds of mechanisms. These are all entities that engage in activities, the causal components of mechanisms. What are activities? So these entities have activities and they interact with each other through their activities. And they're individuated by their spatial temporal location, their rate, duration, the kinds of reciprocal entities and properties required for such activities, their setup, start, and terminating conditions, modes of signaling, and as well as the range and energy requirements. And then finally, there's organization. So you don't just have the components and their activities that generate some phenomenon. The organization matters. So the organization is a real factor here, a real component. And it distinguishes mechanisms from mere aggregates or heaps of matter, such as piles of sand. So the parts act and interact with one another in such a way that the whole is literally not a mere sum of its parts. Mechanisms are in this sense non-aggregative. The parts of the mechanism are organized in the way that go beyond, for example, the contribution made by the mass of a grain of sand to the mass of the pile. Mechanisms are not the mere sum properties of their component parts. And I'll just read this, the second quote. So Craver argues that by virtue of their organization, the real organization, even if it's a rather dynamic organization, of the component parts and their activities, by virtue of their organization, mechanisms are able to do things that their parts cannot do individually. They can respond to inputs that the parts alone cannot detect. They can produce behaviors that their parts alone cannot produce. There are generalizations about the causal relevance that are true of mechanisms and false to their parts. So ion channels alone aren't going to give you an action potential. You're going to need a whole range of organized components in addition to the components of sort of ion channels to get an action potential in a neuron. I think this is the last point then about mechanisms. Another point about mechanisms is that they're multi-level and hierarchically organized mechanisms within a mechanism. So here we have one mechanism, and you can see its component entities. And due to their interactions with each other and their organization, they constitute the whole. So someone doing some sawing, some psychological activity, for instance, but that sawing of this psychological activity of this whole is only possible because of the organization of its component entities, which are doing various physiological factors. But even any one of these components, we can zoom in on and see that it itself is organized by a range of other component entities and their activities. So when this entity carries out its operation for this higher level mechanism, it requires enlisting the properties and the activities of this lower level components and how the way they're organized. Another factor here is that when you do experiments on them, you can do bottom-up interventions where you can do something and manipulate perhaps something with the ion channels, and that's going to affect the way in which the action potential is occurring, or you can affect maybe the way in which vesicles carry various neurotransmitters. If you can block them in certain ways, you're going to affect the way in which the overall neuron and what it can do with respect to the postsynaptic neuron, how it can affect them. But there's also types of bottom or top-down interventions where whatever activity is going on here is going to bring about the coordinated manifestation of these component parts and their activities. So there's ways in which both top-down and bottom-up activities can be done to them to affect the mechanism as a whole. So here's an example that Craver has of explaining, starting at the top level, of the way in which a mouse is able to navigate through a Morse water maze. And that's due in part to zooming in. There's a whole range of explanations, but one of the components of the mechanism of a mouse navigating a Morse water maze is going to be parts of its hippocampus. And its hippocampus is generating, according to a certain cognitive modeling of it, a type of spatial map. And the hippocampus itself is going to be composed of various neurons that can induce long-term potentiation. And this is going to be important, or it's at least hypothesized as important, for a learning mechanism. But in order for this to happen, various types of, amongst other factors, one component in that mechanism is going to involve various neurotransmitters activating and causing, either introducing new ion channel gates or causing certain ones to open and close. Not going into the details of it, you can see how they're nested mechanisms, they're hierarchically nested within each other. Okay, finally the last section. So what are we to do with all this earlier view about this new mechanist view in philosophy of science? What I'm going to do now is suggest the ways in which it can be brought into the Aristotelian view. So it's not a metaphysical view, it's a philosophy of science view, but the way in which it talks about these organized components, it admits of a sort of Aristotelian hylomorphic interpretation. There might be ways of resisting that and saying that it also invites other compatible ontological interpretations, but it does have a sort of view that types of organizational realism are going to be critical for its view, and that's also a component of the Aristotelian account as well. So we're going to end with some of these more general questions. And the first point I want to come back to is a sort of view about the unity of the human persons. So humans have all these powers on this Aristotelian view, and those powers are built out of mechanisms and their organization, which are built out of mechanisms and their organization. But the claim that the Aristotelian wants to make is that all of these are working for the sake of the unity of a human being, for a human person that acts in virtue of these diverse powers. But one thing that Aristotelians add, as well as a lot of religious and other philosophical traditions, is not just an account that's true of all these animals, but something that's unique in the human case. So the Aristotelians, other philosophers, as well as a lot of religious traditions, want to say there's something special about human souls, which are sometimes called rational souls or noetic souls. Noetic comes more from a philosophical tradition. Noetic is connected with Greek words for noesis, a type of insight or understanding. And religious traditions often talk about spiritual souls. So I'm going to try to bring these views together and connect them up with what we've said so far and try to show you how this new mechanist picture fits within this Aristotelian view. One of the things that comes up in religious traditions, especially the Christian and the Jewish tradition, is the idea of the image of God, that somehow human beings are unique amongst creatures insofar as they have some aspect about them that makes them more like God. And this is in part rooted in the idea of the ability to be able to know God and to love God. I was going to go into points from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but given the limits of time, I'm just going to read one of these paragraphs from the treatment of the image of God from the Catholic Catechism. So in paragraph 362, the point about their claim is that the human person is created in the image of God is a being at once corporeal and spiritual. So we see this religious tradition talking about this other component, the spiritual one, that's different from everything I've said about souls so far. And they make the claim then, the next paragraph, that the human body shares in the dignity of the image of God. It's a human body precisely because it's animated by a spiritual soul, or a rational soul, or a noetic soul. And it's the whole human person that is intended to become, in the body of Christ, the temple of the Spirit. So in what way is this religious view compatible with some of the claims that I've been making about the neuroscience? And here we'll get through the last technical bit, and then we'll come back to this general question about how does this sort of religious conception, how can it respond or how can it think about some of these questions or objections from the neuroscience? So with positing this idea, bringing in this idea, this immaterial, this spiritual, this non-bodied powers of rational and noetic powers, how can they interact with all these embodied psychosomatic powers that I was talking about earlier. It sounds like we've kind of got a re-emergence of emergence here. It sounds like we have now a new mental power that's somehow separate from the brain and its structures, not just something that's constituted out of the organization of the brain, like in the way the psychosomatic powers is, but something that seems to be generated as a sort of supple, separate, floating mental power. And on this account, you would think of the intellect acting as something acting directly causally on the brain. But that's not the sort of picture that I'm going to put forward. I'm going to put forward a view that sort of develops on a number of claims that St. Thomas Aquinas has in his version of Aristotelian hylomorphism. And so I'm going to talk about a Thomist approach where the immaterial noetic or intellectual powers interact with the psychosomatic powers I talked about earlier. So on this picture, it's not a separated intellectual powers acting directly on the brain, but somehow these separate immaterial spiritual powers act on the psychosomatic operations, and those psychosomatic operations are themselves powers that are embodied in the nervous system. So first, to make this point clear, we need to talk just very briefly about the way in which psychosomatic powers interact with other psychosomatic powers. So far I've talked about the way in which psychosomatic powers, say let's talk about, let's speak very coarse-grained and think of a power for an animal to pursue a certain end, pursue a certain goal, as well as powers for vision and attention. And so we might have a dog, and it has gotten itself a rabbit, and now it's on its way home to bring this freshly slayed rabbit to its pups. And the dog has not just the psychological powers that are constituted from the mechanistic organization, but there's also another kind of organization here, a type of conscious intentionality, where the dog has a directive, it has an object in mind of bringing home a set of executive functions to bring home the rabbit to its pups. And this allows it, if these powers succeed, to organize all the other powers of the dog, organize its abilities to move, organize its vision and its audition, and so that the dog is inhibiting any distractions. So if a squirrel runs by, that stimulates it, and the dog might be attracted to it, but because of it's able to have this sort of executive function and planning, it can inhibit these alternative stimuli from the environment, and it can continue along the way. So that's going to be in a case of a kind of top-down, where in which the psychological capacities of the dog organize the other psychosomatic capacities, and all of them are enlisting the mechanistic components of the subpsychological parts of its nervous system. Okay? So here's a view about the way in which the psychological are interacting, and that's causing the different components of different powers to be organized according to this sort of psychological organization as well as this mechanistic one. There's a lot more to be said about this view, but now I'm going to complicate it even more. So the claim for the Aristotelian is that just as the way in which these psychosomatic powers, so our power of the dog's ability to make plans and pursue a certain goal, and that can order its auditory powers and its powers of movement, so also these noetic immaterial powers are going to be able to provide a certain kind of noetic or rational organization to the operations of the psychosomatic powers. So earlier we had the planning powers of the animal were able to bring about an organization of all of its other powers, its powers of vision, its powers for motivation, its powers for movement. What the noetic organization is bringing about is it's transforming and organizing the psychological, and then in virtue of them, all the mechanistic organization, so that the animal, the human animal, can engage in types of logical, rational, and moral operations as a whole. So the claim is that there's different types of organization that these powers can introduce with respect to other powers. What the noetic or intellectual or spiritual powers do is they give the human animal the ability to provide a rational organization to its psychosomatic ones. So it's not just being able to train a chimpanzee that can sign a sheet of paper. Here you have a human that also employs similar psychological powers, psychosomatic ones, and similar mechanistic organization of moving itself in a sort of rhythmic way and signing a sheet of paper, but there's a rational organization applied to this as well and coordinates the organization of the psychological, psychosomatic powers and the mechanical ones to bring about the signing of a peace treaty, which might have huge ramifications that are much wider than just thinking about the types of psychosomatic organization and noetic organization. So that was a bit hand-waving, a pretty quick view, but a very critical component of this view. But this is what the part of the claim is that the noetic powers aren't acting directly on the brain, but they're activating and organizing these psychosomatic powers in a way that's similar in which other psychosomatic powers already can coordinate the manifestation of those powers. The view here is one where a human person is the kind of being that has these immaterial powers, these powers that can introduce rational organization to our psychosomatic powers, and the psychosomatic powers are enlisting and drawing upon some of our subpsychological systems, parts of our nervous system and brain. And if there's going to be problems in the way in which the mechanistic organization of the nervous system is functioning, that's going to bring about impediments to the psychosomatic operations, which is going to impede the possibility for the noetic operations to actually introduce any organization into the psychosomatic powers. So let me say that in a way that's not so abstract. And I'm going to do that by talking about a few neuroscientific challenges to the idea of the rational soul. So what happens in the case of some types of neurodegenerative disorders, like dementia? In dementia, there's a lot of different kinds of dementia, Alzheimer's, Lewy bodies, and various other kinds. But what happens is a sort of atrophy and shrinking. The cells of the brain start to die, and they start to shrink. And you especially get significant shrinking in parts where the hippocampus, as well as in other areas of the cortex, parts of the cortex that also start to shrink. But when these cells die, it brings about, for instance, in the case of Alzheimer's, profound memory loss, profound loss of awareness of who other individuals are, of who one is and what they've done. And so what does this Aristotelian view want to say about this, drawing upon these points that I've said so far about the noumechanist story? So for the Aristotelian, the view here is that these neural systems and those mechanisms are having various damage to their components. So in other words, the subpsychological systems are being profoundly impaired. But those components themselves need to have the various operations they engage in, even down at the cell level, in order for neuroassemblies to function at sort of neurosystems level, for them to function appropriately. If you knock out a number of these components or knock out various factors of their activities, they can't engage in the sort of organized way required for producing the phenomenon. But once these systems get more and more complex, we started talking about these psychosomatic powers, the powers of vision, the powers of memory, the powers of the dog to have the pursuit to run home and bring the rabbit to its pups. But if these psychosomatic powers are constituted, they're holes out of the organization of these components, if these components are starting to break down in terms of impediments, they lose those components and their activities and their organization, so that these psychosomatic powers, which are constituted from the organization of the nervous system, they're no longer able to function. So due to problems or impediments at the subpsychological level, the systems at the subpsychological level that ultimately constitute and compose the psychosomatic powers break down. And if the psychosomatic powers, say for instance the activities of memory, can no longer engage in the type of psychological organization, there's going to be impediments to the ability of the noetic powers, the immaterial spiritual ones. They're going to be incapable of introducing any sort of organization into the psychosomatic powers and their organization due to the impediments of the mechanistic components they're made out of. So if there's questions about this, which I imagine there are, that was very fast, we can go over those. But this is one sort of account of how the Aristotelian is going to approach these issues. The brain damage raises lots of interesting questions about what we are, but it's not just simply saying that the whole human being is somehow localized here or just localized in the brain, that there's a range of complex factors for how to interpret this and how to think about the way in which these subpsychological systems are related to the personal level ones in a way in which instances of brain damage are not obviously objections to a sort of view about the immateriality. An emergentist or a Cartesian would have to have a different kind of story, but there would also be a story that they would try to preserve some of these factors coming from neuropsychology. Now, I mentioned in the abstract these Jennifer Aniston neurons. So I should just say something really quickly about them. But what these are is that Quiroga and some other neuroscientists were doing open brain surgery on patients that were conscious because they were having epileptic seizures and they needed to remove certain tissues. But they were also at the same time showing them visual images. And as they were in there with an electrode trying to figure out which areas of the brain that they could remove without causing serious damage, certain neurons, they would show them a picture of Julia Roberts, nothing, they're silent. These neurons don't make any spikes. But then they show them a picture of Jennifer Aniston, and the neurons go wild. And then they show them a picture of something obviously not Jennifer Aniston, and clearly has no association with them, and those neurons don't fire at all. And then they show a different picture of Jennifer Aniston, and once again, the neurons go wild. And so they've done a lot of variations of this, and Quiroga came to Cambridge not long ago, and I was asking him if those were just limited to visual. But what's interesting in these parts of the hippocampus, they can both be associative of both visual imagery as well as auditory. So they're also doing a lot of other factors, like here we've got Saddam Hussein, we've got Yoda, and a lot of Star Wars. And this is a cartoon of how this actually functions. But they were showing a bunch of pictures of Mark Hamill, of Luke Skywalker, and various pictures of Darth Vader. But then they played just an audio of Darth Vader breathing. And the same neurons that would go hot for Luke Skywalker or for Darth Vader would also, you know, they would get very excited just by hearing the auditory. So this is a very interesting and very exciting research that they're doing. And it's very difficult research because they can only do it under very specialized circumstances and conditions. So what would an Aristotelian say to some of this sort of evidence, that these very finely localized components in the hippocampus are responding to very, very selective attunement to various either visual or auditory associations of different types of object recognition? And the story here is going to be pretty similar to the story that I just told a second ago, that there's going to be components in the hippocampus that are attuned to types of informational covariance with, say, for instance, a type of sortle or some sort of way of identifying something like Jennifer Aniston or all the ways in which we have like a recognitional capacity for identifying her. So those components are actually sub-psychological. They aren't themselves an awareness of Jennifer Aniston, of a picture and auditory content connected with Jennifer Aniston. But they are components that have become patterned as part of a larger system, a type of neuroassembly for memory recognition. And these are still sub-psychological, but they're sub-psychological components that are organized into a psychosomatic power for memory and for recognition. And so, again, if we were to have impediments to these psychosomatic powers due to impediments or problems in the hippocampus, it's going to cause problems for these neuropsychosomatic powers. And those impediments themselves would be causing reasons for why there can't be the relevant noetic organization of the psychological powers of memory that are actually embodied. All right, so I'll leave you with that. Summarizing, we talked about the two different kinds of souls, and we contrasted Cartesian minds from Aristotelian animating forms, and then moved on to a distinction between the personal level and the subpersonal level attributes, distinguishing between different emergentist approach to these, as well as holomorphic animalism. And then I turned to an account of Aristotelian souls after neuroscience, and went into some detail about the new mechanist approach to the philosophy of neuroscience, biology, and psychology, and talked about the way in which they described phenomena produced by the organized component entities and activities. And these really function for an Aristotelian a lot like the conjugate powers, the conjugate attributes. And then finally discussed issues with the rational soul after neuroscience. And so what I've tried to address is some questions of why worry about the soul, what are these different views. We'd have to go into much more detail to see what are the serious arguments for defending these various views against rival views. But I hope that I've tried to provide a coherent picture of different views about the souls, and in particular, how the Aristotelian view, which has this tradition that's connected to certain religious traditions and philosophical ones, how that conception of the soul is coming somewhat at a different level than a lot of the issues that are coming up in the neuroscience. And there's a lot of ways of thinking about them as compatible. And at the end of the day, a lot of these questions turns on whose conception of the soul and which sort of neuroscientific interpretations one is going at. And if you have a certain conception of the soul, you're going to probably favor certain types of neuroscientific interpretations that are compatible with that. And that's an understandable instinct. But a sort of rigorous, rational pursuit of the truth would require you to also look very seriously at views and scientific evidences to why you're disinclined to look at certain types of neuroscientific interpretation that are incompatible with the view of the soul that you already have. What are the reasons and motivations, and do you have good arguments for pushing back against that? Do you have the appropriate distinctions and ways of problematizing certain scientific interpretations that are at odds with the conception of the soul that you might want to defend? Right? With that very long talk, thank you very much for your attention.